Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
And good morning again. You are listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr. For the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking Brexit. In just over 3 months' time, on March 29th, United Kingdom will leave the European Union in what has become known as Brexit. Or will it? After a tumultuous week where British Prime Minister Theresa May survived a vote of no confidence over her handling of Brexit, the confusion over what may happen in late March remains. What questions do you have about Brexit as it now stands? Do you think it's a good idea or are you opposed? Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. That's 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. To help us cut through the thicket of proposals, counter-proposals, trade implications, and maybe even an explanation of Boris Johnson's haircut, we have two guests. Frank Langfitt is NPR's London correspondent. He joins us this morning from the UK. Good morning.
Good morning, Ewan.
We're also joined by Amanda Sloat, a foreign policy senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Frank, let me start with you and ask you to bring us up to date with what's happened in the days since Prime Minister May survived that vote. She pledged to try to renegotiate the deal she made with EU leaders, even though they say the deal is a deal, there will be no changes. I mean, what's she been doing?
Well, she went over to Brussels, Ewan, and she tried to basically get some language that would mollify her critics, her many, many critics here in the United Kingdom who say that the deal that she has isn't going to work at all. And she didn't do very well. People in Brussels and the European Union found her unfocused and basically said exactly what you said, which is we've been negotiating this for more than 2 years. We're not going back. So she comes back to London basically with a parliament that at the moment certainly doesn't look like it's going to pass her deal. And she's actually coming out and speaking momentarily in the House of Commons about how things went in Brussels, but also trying to knock down an idea that's been gaining ground in the past few days, really. And that's the idea of actually a second referendum, taking this issue back to the people of the United Kingdom.
Now, this was actually, I mean, it's been floated for a while, but then Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, threw his weight behind it. Theresa May turned around and basically said that he was, disparaging his own former role as Prime Minister by actually going against the will of the people. I mean, is it likely to happen, do you think?
You know, I think that I've been very skeptical about this for all the obvious reasons, and that is when people began to bring it up not many months ago, the whole idea, even people who had voted to remain in the EU said, well, this is anti-democratic. How can you just – you don't like the answer, so you take it back to the people again. What's happened and I feel is different. I spent Friday with a number of analysts here in London, Ewan, who said this may become one of the only ways to resolve this difficulty. So for the moment, there's not enough votes to get Prime Minister May's deal through. Everybody is afraid of leaving the European Union without a deal because that could cause a lot of economic problems, certainly for the United Kingdom and for Europe as well. And so the question is, what's the route forward? And if there's a deadlock in Parliament, is there a possibility that they might actually take this back to the people? I think we're a long way from that. But the fact that people are talking about it in a way that they weren't even 3-4 weeks ago is quite striking.
Well, Amanda Sloat, let me turn to you. And I mean, a question which I haven't really heard a lot of people ask is, I mean, do the Europeans, what do the Europeans want now? Do they want the UK to stay?
Well, the Europeans never wanted the Brits to leave in the first place, but they respected the fact that this was the democratic will of the British people in the referendum. And so they were trying to negotiate a divorce settlement that was going to be in Europe's best interest and that also was going to meet Britain's needs. I think right now you've got a lot of frustration and exhaustion across Europe because of all of the political wrangling that's happening in London. So I think for a lot of people in Europe, they just want to get on with it.
So, I mean, one of the things that we've heard a lot of the argument about is over the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Irish Republic, which is a member of the EU. Amanda, why is this so important?
So under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, you were able to end a lot of the decades of fighting known as the Troubles that had been plaguing Northern Ireland. And part of the clever compromise in that was people could feel either Irish or British. And the fact that they were all members of the European Union meant that they didn't need to change sides. You also had a very open border. You wouldn't even know that you had crossed into a different country unless you saw signs in Gaelic or prices in euros. Once the UK leaves, that is going to become the external frontier of the EU's economic system. And so people are very concerned about, on one hand, how you preserve the sanctity of the EU's trading system, but on the other hand, not putting up infrastructure that's going to be very disruptive to the very fragile peace process that you have there. And so a lot of the unhappiness with Theresa May's deal revolves around arrangements that have been put in place. And essentially what those say is that you would temporarily leave the UK within the EU's customs union, within the trading system, until the UK was able to come up with ways of managing the border or until the UK and the EU sorted out what their long-term relationship looked like. Critics of this deal believe that the UK is going to be trapped in this EU economic system for the long term, which in their mind defeats the purpose of liberating the UK from these mechanisms and freeing them to make their own trade deals.
So we're hoping that our listeners will join into the conversation. You can call us at 651-227-6000, toll free at 800-242-2828. We actually have Simon in Grand Rapids on the line. Good morning, Simon. What's
Good
your
morning.
Observation?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. As you maybe tell from my accent, I'm British. I'm still been working here on a green card for, gosh, a little better than 30 years now. But anyway, I do wish they would have another referendum. I don't know if that will happen or if that's practical, but people were lied to so much in the, you know, the Brexit folks were lied so much about how wonderful, excuse me, everything was based basically on the premise that, you know, we're British, we're smarter, we're better, everybody respects us and we've got so much power and influence in the world. Well, you know, when it's, you know, Britain's just one country and we can't, as important as we think we've been in history, we still are, and we can't get away from the fact that we live in a global world and we're dependent on immigration and we're dependent on trade and we're dependent on any number of other things, you know, never mind the Northern Ireland thing. And I think this is just a classic example of a major self-inflicted wound, and I think there's a big lesson for the United States in here. There's very much, obviously, a theme in recent politics that the United States is so powerful, that we're so special, we're so exceptional, that we really don't need to listen to anyone else. And I think, you know, you won't go on for very long before you find out that, hey, people start thumbing their nose at us and saying, no, you might be the biggest kid on the block, but at the end of the day, if you can't play okay with other people, then it's not going to work out very well. And I just think it's what's happening in Britain is tragic. It was based on anti-foreigner, sort of anti-other sentiment, and that I think you can only get by in the modern world so long with that. And I really think there's a lesson for people on this side of the pond.
Well, let me ask you, Frank Langford, you're there on the ground in London. I mean, does Simon have a point?
I feel like I've been talking to people like Simon a lot recently, but they happened. What Simon is saying captures many of the things that I hear on the streets of London and well beyond London. And I think what's interesting is I hear those particularly from the younger generation. Leaving the EU is going to mean that they no longer have the opportunity to live, work, and study in Europe, and particularly for young ambitious people here, that feels like a great loss. They also, a lot of younger people here tend to see themselves as more cosmopolitan, more European, and so their identity is very different than many older generations. And of course, as you remember in the Brexit vote, there was a big age gap. You had a lot of older people voting to leave for identity reasons, and those are not illegitimate identity reasons. Some neighborhoods changed very quickly here. People felt uncomfortable. There were a lot of strain on resources, government resources. But a lot of younger people would very much agree with Simon. It's a very familiar conversation.
I'm British, and my kids both have U.S. passports. I mean, sorry, U.K. passports, and were really amazed at how much easier it was to move around Europe simply because of that, and are now very upset about the potential loss of that freedom when they go to visit.
Ewan, if I can just jump in here, yeah. I was interviewing a woman 3 days ago in central London who is from the north of England and of Irish heritage, and she was getting an Irish passport and she was leaving the UK because she thought in the end this was only going to do damage to the economy, and she's looking to go to Ireland or the United States.
Wow. So this agreement that Prime Minister May signed with the European Union, we've heard a lot about the Irish situation, but it isn't in fact 1,000 pages long, I believe, more than 1,000 pages long. I mean, what is in there that perhaps we haven't been hearing about? I mean, Amanda, I don't know if you've had a chance to read through it.
I have. I will confess, I have not read it in its entirety. The divorce agreement, I think, is about 585 pages. So there's actually two agreements. One is the withdrawal agreement, and that, if you will, is the divorce settlement. So one of the things that addresses is the rights of UK citizens that are living in other EU countries and the rights of EU citizens that are living in the UK. What will happen to them after Brexit? Another component is the financial part. The UK has signed up to a number of financial commitments in its membership in the European Union, and the EU, not surprisingly, wants the UK to clear its debts before it leaves. Another component of this deals with Northern Ireland. And then the other part of it just deals with all of the mechanisms that you need to wind down all of the things that have been happening in terms of goods that are on the market at the time that Brexit takes effect, regulations, winding all of that down. So once the UK leaves on March 29th, there will be a 21-month transition period. And during that time, everything will essentially remain as it is. And so the second document, which is part of this package, is a political declaration on the future relationship. And so the idea is that during this transition period, the UK and the EU will negotiate on what their future relationship looks like. Will they have a free trade agreement? How closely will they be economically aligned? What types of programs will the UK still participate in the EU?
We have Tom from Edina is on the line. Tom, you have a comment.
Yes. First of all, the UK, they kept their own denomination. And secondly, the EU came into play. And now we're talking about Brexit. But could you please discuss what are the advantages? Because I'm hearing lots of negatives. What are the advantages?
The advantages of leaving the European Union.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Frank, you want to take a run at that?
I'd love to take that. That's a great question, Tom, because we mostly hear in the negatives, and that's true. I think that the advantages, if you talk to a lot of people in the United Kingdom, people who voted to leave, they would tell you, first of all, they now can make their own laws. You know, a lot of the laws that they operate under come out of the European Union. They will be able to control their borders. Now, there was a lot of influx of immigration in the years leading up to the vote. And people complained that, first of all, that some people from Eastern Europe were taking jobs. Certainly, there were lots of complaints about getting wait times for the National Health Service, things like that. And there's also a sense, I think, about a lot of people here is that the country, the demographics of the country, the ethnicity of the country was changing a little too quickly for them, and they want to just slow it down. So a phrase they often use is taking back control. So I think that what you see here, and I think it's our earlier caller hit on it very nicely, is that some of the same factors that drove President Trump's election were also behind Brexit, and that was a desire not to be so globalized, a sense of more of a stronger nation state. And so for people who feel that way, particularly older members of the public, they're very much in favor of Brexit, and they do want to get on with it, and they can't believe it's taken this long.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the question of control because, of course, there was the referendum before that about Scottish independence and the sense that in some of the other members of the United Kingdom, certainly in Wales too and to a certain extent in Northern Ireland, the question about who actually gets to control what. And there has been a certain amount of devolution, but the Scots did actually vote to stay in Europe, as did the people in Northern Ireland, and they're feeling a little irritated by this whole situation.
They are, and you know this country is divided into four sections, and two of them said we want to stay in Europe, so they're not happy about this at all. Absolutely.
I think that's an important point. I actually did my PhD on devolution in Scotland and then lived in Northern Ireland. And so it's a sentiment that I have been focusing on quite a lot. And I think there is a possibility that Brexit is not only going to end up changing the European Union, but it's also going to affect the union of the United Kingdom. We're hearing a lot of talk in Scotland about whether or not they want to have a second independence referendum. They, of course, had an independence referendum in 2014, which failed. But given that 62% of them voted to stay in the EU, there's a lot of sentiment that you could end up seeing a second referendum at some point. And in Ireland, coming out of the Good Friday Agreement, there's been polling suggesting that there is growing support for the reunification of Ireland if the UK ends up leaving, especially with a no deal or with a deal that's seen as being very disadvantageous to people living there.
We're talking Brexit this hour with Amanda Sloat. She's a senior foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institute and NPR's London correspondent, Frank Langford. We'd love if you could join in the conversation with your question or comment. You can call 651-227-6000 or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. So, what about, should this all happen, should there be an exit at the end of March, what is this going to mean to the ordinary American in the street? Anybody want to take
London,
a swing at that?
Mean, in the United Kingdom?
Yeah.
Probably not much. I mean, I think that lines at Heathrow are going to be longer. Certainly, I think that they're already pretty long now. But I think that well, maybe not Heathrow, but certainly going to the European Union, I think it'll be longer, certainly for Brits. I'm not sure that we'll be very affected by it. You know, the other thing is that my passport, I am able to travel almost exclusively visa-free in Europe, and this won't change that at all. So I don't think Americans too much. I don't know, Amanda, do you have any thoughts?
I think it depends. I mean, the UK, of course, is outside the EU's common travel area. And so in that perspective, the Heathrow won't be as affected as much. Part of this is going to depend on whether or not the UK is able to leave with a negotiated deal or whether or not it crashes out. Last week when Theresa May pulled the vote, we saw the pound at an 18-month low against the dollar. The Dow dropped 500 points. So if there is a disorderly exit by the UK from the EU, there is the potential for negative economic repercussions here in the U.S. I think for businesses that are invested in the U.K. stock market, that are trading there, there could be potential spillover effects as well. The United States government has talked a lot about wanting to negotiate a free trade agreement. That obviously will be easier if the U.K. leaves the EU completely. The biggest problem, I think, for the United States is that the UK is one of our closest allies, and it's a partner that we would want to be working with on a number of foreign policy challenges. And because the UK is so domestically focused on trying to resolve all of these Brexit issues, it means they simply don't have the bandwidth to focus on much of anything else.
Well,
Can I jump in here, Ewan? Because I think that Amanda's making a really good point, and I'd like to go a little bit further. And that is, and going back to your first caller, the geopolitical challenges now are really, really big. And just to look at this in terms of Europe is missing the point. The challenges from China and Russia are very, very significant. I worked in China before I came here. And the idea of not having a key ally like the United Kingdom working on these issues in concert with the rest of Europe is got to be very concerning for traditional transatlanticists in Washington, people who believe in the transatlantic alliance. Because Amanda is absolutely right. this country is completely distracted, has been completely distracted for the last 2 years on Brexit, and it's not going to be over anytime soon. I'm just seeing that the Prime Minister May is in the House of Commons now saying she plans a Brexit vote on her deal on January 14th. But this is going to drag on for a long time. And so I think from the perspective of the United States, this is not good to have your key ally at a time of tectonic shifts around the world so distracted on something domestic like this.
So when she says this deal, this is the deal that she didn't put up for a vote last week. She's coming back with it again, or will it be?
She is, and I wish her well. If you talk to most people down in Westminster in the House of Commons, she, at least as of last week, she was expected to lose by scores and scores of votes, perhaps as many as 100. And of course, as we saw, she had 117 members of her own party in Parliament vote no confidence in her. So she has it's a very steep hill for her to climb.
The hope seems to be with her officials that, you know, all of these members will go home for Christmas and eat their fruitcake and celebrate with their families and perhaps come back in January with slightly refocused minds. Or I think as you start to stare into the abyss of what a no deal looks like, that might change people's minds as well. One of the analogies that you sometimes hear is a comparison with the TARP agreement, which was the financial bailout package that the American Congress passed in 2008. And if you'll recall, there initially was a lot of opposition to the deal. The House voted down the deal. They were able to get the Senate to make some very cosmetic tweaks. And then a lot of Democrats and others held their nose and voted to pass it. And so one school of thought is given the fact that there are limited other options, that the EU has been very clear that they are not going to renegotiate, that crashing out of the EU with no deal would be very damaging. There's questions, and it might be wishful thinking, but whether or not some members might come around to grudgingly supporting the deal that's on the table.
Well, let's talk a little about that abyss. I mean, the crashing out, I don't know if you call it the option, the crashing out possibility. I mean, what is that realistically going to mean on that day when
they're running out of time, and they have not planned for this very well at all. So one thought is they would do what they're calling is a managed no deal, which is there would be no future deal, but they would try to manage it as best they can. But boy, they better get on top of it, Ewan, because certainly we've been seeing reports that there could be, you know, big backups at the ports at Dover and places like that. There has been, you know, perhaps some scaremongering reports about stockpiling of medicines and things like that. But you get a sense the government here has not acquitted itself well, regardless of your politics, over the past 2.5 years in terms of getting their ducks in a row and being prepared for any eventuality. So the concern is you get down to March 29th, the day that United Kingdom is supposed to leave, and you could see a lot of disruption at the borders and a lot of certainly economic disruption.
Amanda, what's your prediction about what's going to happen?
Well, it's very, very dangerous to make predictions. On the no deal, you technically would need a border with Northern Ireland, which would be very disruptive. All of those things that I talked about that were in the divorce settlement would no longer come into effect. The rights of citizens, the financial payments, the transition period, and none of the trading arrangements that are currently in place between the UK and EU would be operative anymore. The UK would return to trading under WTO rules, which means all of the tariffs that are in place as part of that system would be in effect. And then all of the agreements that allow planes to land, that allow goods to pass over to France without being checks, you would suddenly need to have checks on all of those things. I mean, at this stage, there essentially seem to be three options. I mean, one, you get the Parliament in January to vote on May's deal. Second, you end up preparing for a no-deal scenario. And then the third, as we talked about, is the potential of a second referendum. The one thing I would add on that we didn't discuss is there's currently no clarity on what question would even be asked in a referendum. Do you have a rerun of the first referendum and ask people if they want to stay in the EU or no? Do you ask people to vote on Theresa May's deal, given that Parliament is divided on the deal? Some people are talking about some sort of two-question referendum where you ask people if they want to leave, and if they do want to leave, do they want to leave on the terms of May's deal? And this isn't easy or quick to stand up. You would need to put the infrastructure into place. You would need to have a campaign period. And for that to happen, you would need to get all of the other EU member states to agree to end this or to extend this March 29th deadline. So as we've been saying, there's not a lot of time for any of these scenarios.
Wow. Actually, can I just jump in here, Ewan, if I could? There was a recent ruling by the European Court of Justice that said that the United Kingdom could actually halt Brexit unilaterally. And the sense that I get from Brussels is if, as long as the United Kingdom had a real legitimate reason for wanting to pause or halt Brexit, they probably would get some assent, especially if it were for a referendum where there was a decent chance of getting a Remain vote. But Amanda is 100% right. There is so much to do. I mean, if there's a no-deal Brexit, there's no way anybody's building customs posts on the border. It's 300 miles long over in Ireland. And they're getting a referendum together and getting people to agree on the questions. Again, it's going to take a long time. So one of the difficulties and I think frustrating things for many people here in Britain is they don't feel the political class has handled this very well, regardless of whether you're Labour or Tory. And it's it feels like the time, time is running out and there's not enough time to really handle this in a very effective way.
We are talking Brexit this morning. Frank Langfitt is joining us from NPR's London Bureau, where he is London correspondent. And Amanda Sloat is a foreign policy senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. She joins us from Washington, D.C. We have a couple of people on the line. Catherine has been very patient, calling in from Minneapolis. Good morning, Catherine. You have a question.
Good morning. Yes. I was wondering if your guests could discuss the issue in the initial referendum about whether or not there had been Russian meddling on social media similar to the meddling that we saw took place in the U.S. in the 2016 election and how that might impact the desire for a new referendum.
Good question. Frank, you want to take a swing at that?
There has been. But I don't know that it was as extensive as it has been here. And I don't think that that is as influential. I mean, people do talk about it, but I think the push for if there is a second referendum, which is very hypothetical, I think that would probably be more driven by the fact of the sense if there is indeed paralysis in Parliament. And also, I think a sense of frustration, earlier on, I think we were talking about this. You were talking about this, Ewan, or one of the callers, that people felt back in 2016 that they weren't given a lot of correct information about an incredibly complex issue that many people here now feel and felt at the time should never be taken to a referendum, a public referendum in the first place, because it's just so hard to make sense of this. You're talking about unwinding an economic relation that's gone on, relationship's gone on for 45 years. So I think it is more along those lines than necessarily Russian meddling. But yes, that has been an element of the conversation.
Amanda, do you have any thoughts on this or?
No, I think that's right. I think there certainly was an element of Russian interference, but then there was also the broader issue of people either not having full information or having wrong information. One of the things that came up during the campaign was this idea that rather than the UK having to give all of its money to Brussels, they could spend this money at home on the National Health Service. And people that had been campaigning for Brexit actually came out the day after the referendum and said that was not really accurate and all of that money was not going to be coming home. I think people that lived in areas that were getting funding from the EU in the form of agricultural subsidies, in the form of regional development funding, were not focused on the fact that they may not be sending money to Brussels, but they also were not going to get money back from Brussels. And so there was a broader sense that people did not fully in some places understand on exactly what they were voting for.
We also have Andrew from Richfield on the line. Good morning, Andrew. You had a question too?
Good morning. Thank you. Right. So Switzerland and Norway are the two countries in the EU that have the highest standards of living and also are not in the EU. So I would like to ask your guests if they think there's a connection there and also whether or not to join the EU has been put to a vote three times and all three times it's been rejected by the voters. So why do your guests think that a so-called people's referendum would have a different outcome this time. Thank you.
Well, shall we start with the countries? Switzerland and Norway, did they have they done better because they're not in the EU?
Well, I'm no expert. I was just in Norway for a different story, and a lot of the reasons that they seem to have done well is North Sea oil and great management of their resources, unlike many other countries that suffer through the resource curse. So that was certainly my brief impression when I was up there working on other stories. I would defer to Amanda, certainly on Switzerland. I haven't followed that closely.
I think that's right. Certainly the fact that Norway has huge oil resources has been a major contributor to their economic success. Switzerland is simply a smaller country. In debating Theresa May's Brexit deal, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not the UK should have an alternative form of a relationship with the EU. And certainly the Norway model is one that is mentioned quite a bit. Now, Norway has said they don't actually want the UK to join the arrangement that they have with the EU because they think it will be disruptive. The Norway model does not fully solve the issue of the border in Northern Ireland. And Norway also allows some free movement of people and services and goods, which is something that people in the UK are unhappy with. So certainly there are other models of relationships that countries in Europe have with the EU that people in the UK could look at as an alternative to formal EU membership. But there are challenges with those models. And I think the overarching problem that we have in the UK is there is no majority for any single approach. There's not a majority for no deal, for staying in, for Theresa May's deal, or for one of these models like Norway has, or, for example, that Canada has. And on the caller's second question on the referendum, that's also a very good question. I mean, what happens if you have a referendum, leaving aside what the question is, and you end up with another result that's around 51% to 49% if it's slightly going the other direction? So there is an emotional appeal to having a referendum, but there is also a risk that it does not fully clarify the question either.
What a mess. What a mess.
Indeed. You know, I think that you hit the nail on the head, Ewan. Again, regardless of whether you believe in leaving the EU or remaining in the EU, this is a colossal mess. I came here just a week before the Brexit vote. I was just assigned here, and I thought I was in for a quiet posting, and it has turned out to be just absolutely extraordinary to watch.
Well, you said that Prime Minister May has just announced there will be this vote in January. Again, mm-hmm. That's about a third of the time before the exit date. I mean, what are we likely to see in coming weeks?
I think things are going to get quiet over Christmas and New Year's, and people will have a much needed break because this has been exhausting, certainly for the political class, but also a lot of people who are involved in it. Then we'll see what happens with her vote. I mean, I don't know what rabbit she's going to pull out of her hat on the 14th to win this. I think that Amanda is right that perhaps if people really look into the abyss and they think, you know, we're heading towards a no-deal Brexit or a referendum, because there are many, many Tory Brexiteers, members of her Conservative Party, who do not want that either, maybe she can pull over enough votes to get it across the finish line. British politics, unlike in the past, very, very unpredictable. But it's anyone's guess, Ewan. Honestly, when you talk to most people here, they kind of shrug their shoulders and say, you know, they'll lay some odds, but they really don't know how this turns out.
So, Amanda, I mean, what's your sense about what's happening in Europe? Is there going to be a lot of behind-the-scenes lobbying going on from the European Union?
I mean, I don't think the EU will be lobbying. I think the ball is really in the UK's court, and the EU is now waiting to see what happens. The one thing that you are starting to see more coming out of the EU is their own contingency planning for a no-deal scenario. I think there is increasing concern in the EU that is where this could end up, and so they are wanting to make sure that they have the necessary preparations underway. You are seeing countries like Ireland and others hire more immigration officials, hire more customs officials, so people are starting to prepare for the worst-case scenario. The other thing to keep in mind is that even if Theresa May succeeds in passing this deal through a parliament, the European Parliament still needs to ratify the agreement. They've said they need about 6 to 8 weeks to do the necessary business there. The Irish Parliament also needs to ratify. And then the British Parliament needs to pass all of the legislation that actually would implement the deal. And so with Theresa May holding this vote in mid-January, you are getting very, very very close to a time frame that is needed for all of the other legislative mechanisms to still take place.
This is really, if it weren't so serious, it would be hilarious. But it's absolutely fascinating. Our guests today have been Amanda Sloat, who's a foreign policy senior fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., and Frank Langford is NPR's London correspondent, calling in, of course, from London. Thank you both very much for joining us today. This was an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I'm sure it's going to be going on for weeks, months, and maybe years. You're listening to NPR News.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.